Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined to me and heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay, and he set my feet upon a rock, making my footsteps firm. And he put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and will trust in the Lord. How blessed is the man who has made the Lord his trust and has not turned to the proud nor to those who lapse into falsehood. Many, O Lord my God, are the wonders which you have done and your thoughts toward us. There is none to compare with you. If I would declare and speak of them, they would be too numerous to count. Sacrifice and meal offering you have not desired. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. I have proclaimed glad tidings of righteousness in the great congregation. Behold, I will not restrain my lips. O Lord, you know. I have not hidden your righteousness within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your loving kindness and your truth from the great congregation. You, O Lord, will not withhold your compassion from me. Your loving kindness and your truth will continually preserve me. For evils beyond number have surrounded me. My iniquities have overtaken me so that I am not able to see. They are more numerous than the hairs of my head, and my heart has failed me. Be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. Make haste, O Lord, to help me. Let those be ashamed and humiliated together who seek my life to destroy it. Let those be turned back and dishonored who delight in my hurt. Let those be appalled because of their shame who say to me, aha, aha. Let all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. Let those who love your salvation say continually, the Lord be magnified. Since I am afflicted and needy, let the Lord be mindful of me. You are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, O my God.
In verse 17 of Psalm chapter 40, it says, you are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, O my God. You see, we are in bad shape. I don't know if you recognize this or not, but you need to. That you are bad. Really bad. And when we are born, we are born into sin. And Romans chapter 3 lays out a most convincing case against mankind and their sin. You don't have to turn there, but I'm going to read part of it if you'd like to. But in Romans chapter 3, Paul writes this, that everybody, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good. No one. There's not a person in here who has done good when compared to God. Not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. This is where we're at. This is humanity. There is a problem in this world. And we see it all the time. We see evidence of it in our own lives and in the lives of those around us. We see death. We see destruction. And there is no other way to answer that question than to recognize the presence of sin and evil in this world. You see, if we're really getting better, If evolution and that idea really could hold water, then why is it that babies die? Why is it that we're even trying to fight disease? I heard a guy preaching on this, and he asked this question. Why are we even trying to fight it? I mean, if evolution is real, then it's really trying to sort out the weak among us. It's survival of the fittest, right? And so we should just let nature, let evolution take its course, and the weak and sickly among us should be weeded out by disease and death, and those of us that are strong will rise up, and we'll have a strong race, right? I'm just saying that's the logical conclusion if evolution is the case and that we're getting better and better and better. But there's a problem. We're not. Things aren't getting better and better and better. And no matter how much we try to fight disease and death and sickness, we still have people dying. Constantly. Every day, people are facing death and destruction because of sin. Sin is an awful, hopeless reality. And many people, it doesn't take a lot to grasp this concept. I mean, like I said, you just look around, you see the death and destruction, you see the bad, and you recognize that there is a hopelessness here. In our grammar classes that I teach at school, I teach literature as well, and we read some people who saw the evil in the world, but didn't see Christ. And what it rooted in them was a pessimism that is beyond description. I mean, it's surprising that they lived as long as they did, as depressing as their works sound. They are constantly weighed down. They don't see how there can be any hope in this world because we're constantly hurting each other. We're constantly living for ourselves, and people are dying, people that don't deserve to die in our minds, people who ought to be alive. And then they face death. It's an awful, hopeless reality that I think David echoes in Psalm chapter 40 in a couple of different places. In verse 17, he says, "As for me, I am poor and needy, but the Lord takes thought for me." In verse 2, he says, "He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog." This is the hopelessness. This is the world because of sin. The pit of destruction. The miry bog. And in our humanity, what we try to do is by our own strength and our own power try to deliver ourselves. We believe that we are strong enough. We believe that if we just try hard enough that we can fight off death, that we can beat it eventually. If we take the right precautions, if we exercise and take our medicine, and we continue to fund all of the cancer-fighting funds out there, we continue to fund AIDS research and stem cell research and whatever you can name, if we just continue to fight and fight and fight, that someday we're gonna lick this death thing, that we're gonna get it. And we strive to deliver ourselves because we actually believe that we are, or that we have arrived, and that we can. However, when we realize who we are, when we come to the awesome realization of who we really are, we realize that we're hopeless. We're hopeless to help ourselves. And we need someone to intervene who is much, much stronger than we are. We are hopeless. and we face a dark and dismal future if it's up to us. And I hope I'm painting a very bleak picture in your mind right now. I hope that you are sensing the desperate hopelessness of a world that is lost in sin. There is nothing we can do for ourselves. There is none righteous. We are bent toward sin. It is what we want to do. We are bent toward destroying ourselves. It's only by the grace of God that we do not. We are hopeless by ourselves. Our only hope for deliverance, only hope, there is no hope at all outside of God. And I think in Psalm 40, David depends on and extols five areas of God's deliverance. You see, he recognized his hopelessness. He recognized where he was in his life, in the midst of the pit of destruction, in a miry bog, poor and needy. And he saw God. And if we can see God, then we as well can extol him for his deliverance. We can praise him as our help and our deliverer. And so let's look at these five areas where God can deliver us. I see, first of all, he can deliver us from sin and death. And I see a metaphor here. I think that David is using figurative language, and I think that he could be talking about any sort of deliverance from God. But I think that the fact that he says that he was in the pit of destruction and the miry bog, I really feel like that describes in figurative language what it's like to be in sin. When we live for ourselves, when we're living for our own agenda, that is us in the pit of destruction and in a miry bog. We cannot get ourselves out. But God comes along. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. The end of verse 2, he set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. And by the way, I'm going to give five, but I think that this one overarches all others. There is no deliverance from God outside of this first deliverance from sin and death. And let me tell you how he did it. This is important. This is probably the best part. You see, God saw us in our hopelessness as soon as it happened. In Genesis 1 and 2, things are going pretty good. In fact, God says it. It's good. Pretty stark contrast to what Romans 3 says, right? There is none who does good. And yet God says in Genesis 1 and 2, it is good. He saw his creation and said, it is good. He saw all of nature and the crown man, the image of himself on earth, displaying his glory, and he said, it is good. But then sin comes along. And Eve and Adam are tempted. They're drawn away of their own lusts, their own desires, their desire to be like God, to be somebody that they shouldn't, dissatisfied with all of the perfection that God had given them and all of the wonders of creation. And they sought their own way for satisfaction. And they ate the fruit. And sin comes into the world, and shame and death. And God comes to them and talks to them. He finally gets it out of them that they had disobeyed him. And he tells Eve, he says, your seed will bruise the serpent's head. And whether or not Eve understood all that that meant or not, I'm not here to debate. But it is clear from the rest of Scripture to us that he was prophesying the birth of his Son, Jesus Christ. And what God did at that point is he told them, listen, there is hope. He painted a bleak picture for them too. He said, you're going to die. And Eve, it's going to hurt a lot when you give birth. And Adam, it's going to stink to work. You're going to be fighting the ground the rest of your life. And life is going to be painful and hopeless. But listen, there's hope. There's hope. It's in the seed of the woman. Not all of it, not seeds. The seed of the woman, singular. The one, the promised one. Who would bruise, or would crush the serpent's head. I think I quoted that wrong. He would crush the serpent's head. And so, God gives the promise, and life goes on. And I really think, by the way, that Eve thought Cain was the fulfillment of that promise. I think based on her reaction to his birth, that God had given her a man. But things go on. And things continue. Eventually, God chooses a man called Abraham. And he says, listen, I want you to leave where you're at, leave your family, go to a land that I'm going to show you. Trust me on this. And I'm going to make your name great. I am going to give you seed that is beyond your imagination. I'm going to make a great nation of you. And I am going to bless all the nations through your seed. Again, singular. Seed. And that seed is again, the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Go along a little bit further. Finally, there is a nation from Abraham. And God gives them a law to live by, seeking to draw them to himself and reveal to them how much they need him. And yet they rebel, and they do their own thing, and they refuse to see the heart of the matter, the heart of what God wants. Finally, 2,000 years after the giving of that law, an exile, a return, and 400 years of silence later, God speaks. And he spoke in an interesting way, kind of a crazy lunatic in the wilderness, dressed in animal skin, eating bugs, starts announcing, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And there's one that comes after me whose sandal I am not even worthy to untie. And along comes Jesus. God made flesh, born of a virgin. God steps into history, lives a perfect, sinless life. And at the end of 33 years, is tried as a criminal and crucified as a criminal. He didn't do anything wrong. He never sinned. He never broke a law. And yet, he's crucified as a criminal, treated as a common criminal, humiliated. Why? God made him who had no sin to be sin for us so that we might be the righteousness. So we might have the righteousness of God in him. You see, he took our sin. He took your sin. He took the hopelessness of mankind on himself. And he bore it all. For you and for me. And this is how God displays his great love for us. You see, even though we rebelled, and even though we sinned back in Eden, and even though we continue to rebel and sin in our own lives, God showed his love for us while we were still sinners, and he sent Jesus Christ to die for us. He took your sin. He took your hopelessness on the cross. And by putting your faith and trust in that work, not anything you do, and accepting it for you as enough, is the cross really enough to get you to heaven? That's the question you have to ask yourself. Is it possible that a man could die on a cross and save the whole world? That's what we struggle with. That's what we have to wrestle with. And if so, then believe it. Put your faith and trust in the finished work of Jesus Christ. That is all that you need. Depend on it. Rest on it. Fall back on it to get you to heaven. That is setting your feet on a rock and making your steps secure. That's what God did for David. He took him up out of the mire of sin and destruction and hopelessness and pulled him up and said, here's a rock to stand on. Jesus Christ and his work and my work. Your steps are secure. Notice this as well. He changes his life. He puts a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. It changes his life. I don't think this is specifically talking about music here. I think it's just talking about the change that took place. You see, I was in a pit of destruction and sin, and my life showed it. And now there's a change. I've been sanctified. Because I've been justified, my feet are on a rock. I have a new song. I have a new life. I have a new hope. And so, this overarches all other areas of deliverance that I'm going to mention. Without this one area of deliverance, if you have not accepted that Jesus Christ alone can deliver you from the power of sin and death, then you have no other deliverance that I'm going to mention today. There is no deliverance outside of that. If you can't depend on Christ for this, then you cannot depend on Him for anything else. This is where it starts. You depend on Him for your salvation. You depend on Him for deliverance from sin and death. And then you are delivered to the life of deliverance. Because it's continued trust. It starts at this point. I'm in the pit. I'm in the mire. I can't help myself. God gets me out, and I keep trusting on God to send me along. He's the one that makes my steps secure. Not me, not what I do, nothing else. It is God. Depend on Him for this, and depend on Him for everything. Everything from here on out is God, and God alone. And so he says in verse 4 and 5, "Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, who does not turn to the proud, to those who go astray after a lie. You have multiplied, O Lord my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts toward us. None can compare with you. I will proclaim and tell of them, yet they are more than can be told." There is too many good things that God has done. And you see, this tells me that God delivers us from dissatisfaction. God can deliver you from dissatisfaction that causes you to make the same mistake that Adam and Eve made in the Garden of Eden. You see, they were dissatisfied with everything that God had given them. They thought there was something better. When the serpent came along and said, "Listen, you can be like God." Oh, that sounds good. I'd like to be like God. I'm dissatisfied with not being like God. I'm going to eat the fruit so that I can be like God. They're dissatisfied. Recognize that there is no dissatisfaction with God. If you are trusting and depending fully and completely on God, there is no dissatisfaction. God is all in all. He says, "You have multiplied your wondrous deeds and your thoughts toward us." None, nothing compares with God. Nothing. He alone is everything. So what are you dissatisfied with? What is it in your life that you're just not quite like, man, it's just not quite there, God? Is it your finances? Is it your marriage? Is it your kids? Is it your job? The more dissatisfaction you feel toward those things, the higher the probability that you're going to end in sin. But the more satisfaction that you find in God, the higher the probability that you end in praise and glory of God, because He alone, nothing compares to Him. He is everything. And don't get dissatisfied with all of the things that you feel like could be better, all the things that you think you deserve in this world, because you really deserve nothing. Become satisfied completely in God. In Psalm 37, just a few psalms back, David says this, delight yourself also in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Become satisfied in God, and you'll have all that you ever need. You'll recognize that you don't need anything else but God, because none compares with Him, he says here. There are so many things that He's done for you, so many good things in your life because of God that you can't even tell of them if you tried. You try starting. You can't. Because none compares with God. And He has multiplied His wondrous deeds and His thoughts toward us. He doesn't only deliver from dissatisfaction, He also delivers from religiosity. Nice word, huh? Sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but you have given me an open ear. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I desire to do your will, O Lord. Your law is within my heart. You see, it's not an empty religious ritual that we're promoting here. If you're looking for religion, you are in the wrong church. This is not religion. This is relationship. And if you're trying to do religion here, I hope that you are confounded and frustrated. Because religion is empty, and it is void of God. There is no hope in religion. He basically says God is not wanting sacrifice and offering. This is all of what the law talks about. The law continues to talk about sacrifices and offerings over and over again. And here David says, that's not what you've desired, and it's not what you've required. What does he want? He wants his law written in your heart. He wants a relationship with you. It's not about a bunch of stuff that you do. It's not about even being here, although I think it's beneficial. But it's about having a growing, vibrant love relationship with Jesus Christ, knowing Him in His Word, embracing Him in what He's doing in your life, trusting Him. It's not about religion. In verses 9 and 10, we see then that he delivers us from shame. I have told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. Behold, I have not restrained my lips. As you know, O Lord, I have not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation. Notice what he says. I have not restrained. I have not hidden. I have not concealed. We don't have to be ashamed of Jesus Christ. Paul said he wasn't ashamed of the gospel. Why? Because it is the power of God unto salvation. The verse that Ben quoted this morning. His power. And you have that deliverance. If it's real, if you've really been brought out of the miry pit, if you've really been brought up from the pit of destruction, how can you not proclaim his great deeds? How can you conceal them within your heart? David said, I cannot. I am not ashamed. I have not hidden. Instead, I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. Speak of it. You don't have to be ashamed. It's the power of God. It's capable of changing a life just like it changed yours. Did it change your life? It's capable of changing anybody's life. The same way. It's the same power. And it might seem like your life was in such a mess that it used up all the power to save it. But there is infinite power. And there is no life beyond the reach of Jesus Christ and His power and the power of the gospel. Let it shine. Proclaim it to the ends of the earth. Let everyone know of the great deliverance and salvation of our God. Finally, in these last few verses, I see that we have a deliverance from oppression. And I want to say that this is not, I don't see this as a political oppression, although I think that in David's life that had a realm. But I think that this is mainly for us a spiritual oppression. And I don't think it's just, I think it can be us oppressing ourselves as well as oppression from the outside. Maybe demon or Satan or something like that. I think that there is an effect that can be had on a Christian by the works of the power of Satan, although he cannot indwell a believer. In verse 11 it says, "As for you, O Lord, you will not restrain your mercy from me. Your steadfast love and your faithfulness will ever preserve me. For evils have encompassed me beyond number. My iniquities have overtaken me and I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head. My heart fails me." He's oppressed here. He is distressed, even though he's already had his feet set on a rock. "Be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me, O Lord. Make haste to help me. Let those be put to shame and disappointed altogether who seek to snatch away my life. Let those be turned back and brought to dishonor who desire my hurt. Let those be appalled because of their shame who say to me, 'Aha, aha.'" You see, there's this oppression in our lives from sin. He talks about his iniquity in verse 12. There's an oppression in our lives because of our sin. Our iniquities seem like they're heaping up around us. When we sin and we do our own thing, it's like, oh man, I did it. I messed up again. And our lives seem like they're in distress and turmoil sometimes, even as Christians, even if we've already experienced that first deliverance. Even from the outside, he says, "Let them be put to shame and disappointed altogether who seek to snatch away my life." I think this was a literal thing for David was dealing with here, that there were people actually trying to kill him. We don't really have that today much, at least in America. But I think that there is a spiritual idea here where there is Satan and sin and even people sometimes who are seeking to snatch away our spiritual life. They're trying to dishonor us and desiring our hurt. They revel in our being brought down. Why? Because they are convicted by our testimony. And yet, I think we have deliverance from this. Look at the contrast in verse 16. He says, "But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad." He's like, bring these people, bring my sin and even myself when I'm oppressing myself, and the people who are desiring my hurt, bring them to shame, dishonor them. But may those who are seeking you rejoice and be glad. May those who love your salvation say continually, "Great is the Lord." And I think that that's the deliverance when you see that God is hope and salvation. You hope in God. I think verse 17 is sort of like a restatement of verses 2 and 3. Or actually just 2, I guess. "As for me, I am poor and needy from the pit of destruction, the miry pit. The Lord takes thought for me. You are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, O my God." It's only the Lord who is David's help and deliverer, and it's only the Lord who is your help and deliverer. I hope that you understand one thing in all of this. Everything that I've talked about today is true because of the gospel. It's true because Jesus Christ died on the cross according to the scriptures. He was buried. And then he rose again the third day according to the scriptures. That's what makes deliverance possible. There is no deliverance outside of the cross. Whether or not you sit here today as a Christian or unsaved, having no relationship with God, let me tell you this, that the gospel is your only hope. Every person in this room, the gospel is your only hope. If you are here and you have never had a relationship with Jesus Christ, you've never put your faith and trust in the gospel of Jesus Christ to save your soul, let me tell you, that is where it starts. Your only hope for this world, your only hope to get rid of the destruction and the miry bog that you're in and have your feet set on a rock is in the gospel of Jesus Christ. But let me say too that those of you who have a relationship with Jesus Christ, that the gospel isn't just for getting you out of the pit. The gospel is what sets your feet on a rock. Trust the gospel in every other part of your life as well. The gospel ought to impact every moment of every day that we live. If we understand the gospel, we will be satisfied completely in Jesus Christ. If we understand the gospel, we will never seek religion as a substitute for a relationship. If we understand the gospel and we trust the gospel and we love the gospel, we will never be put to shame because we'll understand it's the power of God to salvation. And if we trust the gospel, we can never be oppressed because the gospel is what delivers us from oppression. It's all about the gospel. It is Jesus Christ dying on a cross and taking your sin, becoming sin for you, so that you can be made the righteousness of God in Him. Become the righteousness of God. Let the gospel penetrate every part of your life and see the change. See that at the end of the day, you'll say, Lord, you are my help and my deliverer. Great is the Lord.